This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Before becoming host of Where We Live, I was a public radio reporter for about 17 years. There are so many stories to tell in our communities, but often we're restricted by story length. Is this a 1 or 2 minute story that airs during our newscast, or does it warrant the 4 to 5 minute feature? Where We Live gives us a chance to focus on the stories of residents in a more thoughtful way. That's why today, Where We Live, I've invited a couple of residents into the studio to talk about a population they're a part of, a group that's often overlooked, not just here in Connecticut, but across the nation. Earlier this month, President Obama delivered a keynote address to the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies.
No matter what your background, no matter what your story, whether you're first generation or fifth generation American, you're bound by something more powerful than your differences, and that is this unshakable faith in America. That notion that here, in this country, we can make of our lives what we will. And the AAPI community, you're part of the lifeblood of this nation.
AAPI, he's referring to Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. We're going to learn about population trends in Connecticut, and we'll hear from Asian Americans who live here about their experiences growing up in the U.S., the stereotyping they've experienced, their views on how Asians are depicted in media, including the entertainment industry. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation. Comment on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. On the phone with me now is Moy Moy Hin McCormick. She's the Executive Director of the Connecticut Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission. Moy Moy, thanks for joining Where We Live.
Thank you, Lucy, for the invitation.
So traditionally when we say the phrase Asian Americans, people may typically think of Chinese Americans or Japanese Americans. Maybe they think of Indians. Who does your commission represent? How many subgroups are we talking about?
So our commission actually has a variety of different subgroups that we represent. And I think a lot of times it's broken down geographically to be able to provide, some additional information. So we have the Southeast Asians, we have East Asians, we have Pacific Islanders, there are different communities throughout Connecticut that our commission represents, and we are responsible for, each of the 169 towns. So it's not as if we're just concentrating solely on one community over the other.
We hear that the Asian American population has grown considerably across the country. Just in Connecticut alone, about 65% from 2000 to 2010. So where do you see these pockets in Connecticut, and why this growth?
So, absolutely, as you indicated, Lucy, the population in Connecticut grew 65% in 10 years. Nationally, it's grown 46% in 10 years. By 2015, we are expected to have a little over 40 million APIs throughout the United States. And I think what we've been seeing is similar to the national trend. We have a lot of increase in different communities. We've seen an increase in the Southeast Asian communities because of their own refugee status regarding, after the war that took place back in the 1970s. You have a lot of, you have several resettlement agencies that are actually located throughout Connecticut, Hartford, New Haven, that assist these refugee populations. The more established, communities like the Chinese and Japanese continue to grow as well. Asian Indians are our largest, ethnic group in Connecticut, followed by the Chinese, followed by the Filipino. The national trend is Chinese represents the most APIs, and then Filipinos, and then Asian Indians. So the trends are similar, as you could tell.
And what has attracted Asians to Connecticut? What fields of industry?
Well, I think, it's very similar to other communities in the sense of employment and education are primary attractors for different communities and different groups. And the Asian community stems back, all the way to the 1800s, the United States, from the Gold Rush to the Transcontinental Railroads to agriculture. So it really has a lot of history that the Asian Americans have brought to the United States. Educational opportunities is always huge, where you have a lot of students. You have a lot of other opportunities for students as well. And then you also have individuals with the refugee status, as I indicated, in addition to wanting to have a better life, you know, trying to attain that American dream that a lot of groups can, you know, definitely relate to.
And tell me about your background, Moy Moy. How did your family end up in Connecticut?
So I am a refugee from Laos. I consider myself Chinese Lao American. We were very fortunate to be able to come to the United States because we had sponsorship from a church in Wallingford. The church basically said to their, you know, members, we have a young family coming from Laos with, you know, two kids, parents that are in their 20s. We really need some families to be able to help out. So back then, sponsorship was really a little bit different than how it is now. What ended up happening is the church had two families that really stood up and said, we definitely want to welcome these, you know, this family to Connecticut. They helped us from, you know, helping my dad to navigate and, you know, learn the driver's test, to attaining a job, to helping my sister and I with English. So they really were very, very crucial in us being able to be where we are. It's very difficult to come to a foreign place, not by choice. So that's the other part is, you know, when you're a refugee, you're not coming and leaving by choice. It's because you're seeking safety. You know, you really are fearful of your life because of government, because of religious persecution or what have you. So it's not by choice that the refugees do come, but when they do come, they try to do what they can as fast as they can. And it's still very difficult. Not only do you have, you know, cultural issues, you have language issues, you have assimilation, you have, you know, cross-generational. So there's a whole host of different things that come when you do come to the United States.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Moy Moy Hin McCormick, Executive Director of the Connecticut Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission. Also in studio with me are two Asian Americans who grew up in Connecticut. Sunny Chen is a Chinese American and a West Hartford resident, also owner of Black Bamboo Restaurant. And Quinn Truong is a Vietnamese American and Hartford resident. Thanks for joining Where We Live.
Thanks, Lucy.
So, Quinn, I'll start with you. Tell me about your family's arrival here in the U.S.
So our family came in late 1990, and we are part of a wave of Vietnamese immigrants who came in the 90s as a result of legislation to help the former kind of prisoners of war in Vietnam. So my dad was in the Vietnamese re-education camps for 7 years after the Vietnam War. And so because of his experiences there, I guess the American government created a program called the HO program that allowed families of these Vietnamese men from the South Vietnamese Army to come over in the 90s.
And Sunny, how about you?
Well, my parents came here when they were probably in the late 80s, and they're coming here for just a better life, more opportunities. Over there, they couldn't get a job and just better opportunity for us as a family.
And what was your assimilation like here in Connecticut? I understand both of you grew up in West Hartford.
That's right. Yep.
Sunny?
I can't hear you. Say that again.
What was it like growing up in West Hartford for you?
I grew up in Hartford, but I just moved to West Hartford about six years ago. But growing in Hartford was different. You know, I came here, I didn't speak any English. You know, it was hard just finding friends and just communicating with my friends. But it's definitely it was really hard. I never seen a people of color before back in China. As so, when I first came here, it was a little bit like frightening seeing people of different color because I had never seen before. Mm. So it was tough growing up.
Mm-hmm. I had a really different experience. So my family came right away to West Hartford, and my parents scrapped, you know, funds together, and we lived in a basement apartment just so that we could go to the West Hartford school system. And I grew up with a lot of Jewish kids. I was surrounded by a lot of Caucasian kids. And, you know, I grew up as one of the few handful of, you know, Asian kids in the entire elementary school, you know, for a while. I knew every single other Asian kid, and most of the other Asian kids were Vietnamese. So I had a very different sense of diversity and of myself. And I didn't get that sense of diversity. I don't think that you did growing up in Hartford.
No, I just want to say what Quinn says. It's true. I was the I went to No Webster. I remember elementary school in Hartford and West End. I was me and this other guy. I remember his name is Chris. We're the only Asians mm-hmm. in the whole school. And I was just thinking, you know, without him, there's no one really I could connect to or even translate mm-hmm. kind of what was going on in school. And, you know, because I came here, I speak zero English. Mm-hmm. I never, you know, I grew up in China back kind of in a farm area. So there was no even TV about hearing English. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely it was, you know, it has a lot of other like Hispanic No Webster did provide a good ESL program, but it was tough.
Yeah. I grew up and I went to Webster Hill Elementary School, which is in West Hartford, and had an excellent ESL program. But still, you know, I came from speaking no English, and then I came to, you know, I was in second grade, and suddenly I was surrounded by kids who didn't look like me, who didn't talk like me, who had very different food, you know, during lunch, and it was definitely a huge growing up experience.
I wanted to go back to you, Moy Moy, as executive director of the Connecticut Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission. You know, how does the commission work to reach Asian Americans, whether they've been here for many generations or they are new to our community?
Thank you, Lucy. That's a great question. So I think a lot of our efforts and focus is really about getting to know our community. It's about, you know, going into various towns and cities and meeting with community leaders, community members, and trying to provide the education and outreach that's needed, in addition to attaining the important information about concerns and other issues that our community members express, and then bringing it to the government, bringing it to providers, trying to bridge that gap. It's a lot of work because we don't have just, you know, a predominant kind of one ethnic group in Connecticut. We have a variety of different communities with multiple languages and, you know, differences in needs. It's not the homogeneous in the sense of we're all the same Asians, we look the same, speak the same, have the same needs. So it becomes a little bit challenging as to, you know, how we're able to gather and then really bring attention to specific needs that we have.
This is Where We Live. Are you a first or second generation Asian American? What brought you and your family to the U.S., to Connecticut? Tweet us or find us on Facebook at Where We Live. Now, Moy Moy, I think it's interesting that you were talking about the commission's work because just in the last week with the new budget that was approved by the General Assembly, there was a proposal that these commissions would be merged from, I think, six to just two. So how will your work be affected?
Well, Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission will be eliminated as of July 1st, just like the other five legislative commissions. This is very unfortunate. It's really disheartening, especially because May is National Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and Connecticut has really been seen as one of the leading states to be able to welcome and accept and provide those resources. Now I think this really puts us, you know, backwards. You're talking about marginalized communities historically and presently, and now we're taking independence away from each of our commissions and consolidating, which is really eliminating and creating two new commissions. The budget did pass the Senate and House last week, and now it's going to the governor's office for signature. And the new two commissions will be Commission on Equal Opportunity, which is supposed to have a policy division of Asian Pacific Americans, African Americans, and Latino Puerto Rican Americans. And then the other second commission is Commission on Women, Children, and Elderly. And it's going to have policy divisions of women, children, and the elderly. So obviously we're not going to be able to continue the work that we've been doing. We've had great initiatives and projects that we've been working on, from Problem Gambling Initiative, where we're partnering with DMIS Problem Gambling Services and Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, which is a nonprofit, and community leaders to be able to really provide culturally, linguistically, education and outreach to our various communities. We've had the iSpeak cards, which raise awareness about language rights. Anybody receiving or anybody going to federally funded services such as hospitals, they actually have the right to have a qualified interpreter. Responsibility is placed on the provider and not the community, which a lot of times I think our community members feel like it's their responsibility. You know, there's business initiatives that we've started and continued, mental health needs, medical needs. It's just a host of stuff, Lucy.
When we look at the makeup of the General Assembly, I think I can think of three Asian Americans who represent some towns and cities in the state. Is that correct?
That is correct. So we have Senator Tony Wong, we have Representative William Tong, and then we have Representative Dr. Prasad Sirinivasan. Those are the three.
And have they weighed in on the work of the commission?
They have, and, you know, we've been able to partner with their offices and with them as well for previous projects and initiatives that we've had. They've attended, you know, various events that we've hosted. They've been guest speakers, so we have been able to work with them.
You touched on disparities that exist among the Asian American population in Connecticut, across the country. This is something we're going to talk about a little further later in the show. But, you know, there's that idea that Asians are the model minority, that they don't have any issues in their lives, that they do well in school, they have great careers. Can you talk about how that is a challenge when we know that there are needs in all communities?
Absolutely. So the model minority myth really creates barriers for our communities to receive funding and services. A lot of times when we have a review reports, assessments, we see either very, very low numbers of Asian Americans or we don't see them at all. And a lot of times what I've been really trying to encourage others attaining this information is question your source and start asking, how are you gathering your information? How many Asian Americans are you actually surveying or asking to participate? You know, because those numbers could be very low. It doesn't mean that there's not an issue of mental health or medical or housing or education. It means that, you know, these communities aren't being asked to participate, or if they are being asked, they're not getting high responses. And if they're not getting high responses, then it goes to questioning the outreach and the recruitment, you know, how effective is somebody or some agency able to actually engage Asian Americans, you know, into the work. It creates a lot of barriers, like I said. You know, funding doesn't get focused to the Asian Americans because people assume that there's no medical needs, there's no mental health issues, there's no educational. You know, it really is where if people aren't making an issue, and I think that's an assumption that people are making as well, if they're not hearing from, if they're not seeing the complaints, then there's not an issue. And that's, you know, really not true. There's a lot of basic needs our Asian communities are faced with. The Muslim and Sikh communities, you know, after 9/11, I mean, we hear it, we see it all the time in the news, in Connecticut, nationally. They're targeted for hate crimes, harassment, discrimination. It just goes on and on and on. Bullying for our children. You know, there's just so many different disparities that go unmet and untreated because there aren't resources. And the resources that are out there aren't culturally appropriate or linguistically appropriate.
Before we go to a break, I just wanted to circle back to our guests in studio. When your families came here to Connecticut, you mentioned, Sunny, that there was another kid that also was of Asian descent, but that was really it. So do you remember any support systems in place to help your families? Or was it just, you know, if you saw another immigrant family or someone of your background that you felt that you had a commonality there?
Excuse me. There's no really, I don't think there was really support system. It's mainly just, you know, support from your family that who came here before, you know, a couple year ahead of us. Basically, everybody kind of, no one really reached out, you know, to us or kind of, you know, just, you know, my cousin that who was, you know, they've been here probably 10 years ago that, you know, they have a house here and stuff. Basically, just, you know, from family members supporting.
So relying on family. And Quinn, did you and your family seek out other Vietnamese?
Yeah, so I think similar to Sunny, we relied on our family for everything. And I, you know, speaking to what Moi Moi was talking about, Asian Americans underutilize social services because it's not in our culture to seek these things out. That doesn't mean that we don't have these needs, but we fear that it's going to be too much, and we don't want to put ourselves out there. And so we'd rather, you know, double up on housing or just not talk about our issues until they become an issue. And so it's good to hear Moi Moi talk about some of these bigger problems.
We need to take a break. I want to thank Moi Moi Hin McCormick, Executive Director of the Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission. We heard her say on the air starting July 1st that commission will no longer exist. Moi Moi, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Lucy.
This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're focusing on Asian Americans. They're the fastest growing minority group in the state and in the U.S. In studio with me are two residents whose families moved here when they were young children. Sunny Chen is a Chinese American and the owner of Black Bamboo Restaurant in West Hartford. And also Quinn Truong is a Vietnamese American who lives in Hartford. Are you Asian American? What was it like growing up in Connecticut? Or did you move here as an adult and now raising kids born in the U.S.? How do you hold on to your customs and culture? Comment on our website, WMPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So I wanted to actually take a phone call now. Rehan from Middletown is calling. Thanks for calling Where We Live, Rehan.
Hi, Lucy. How's it going?
I'm well, thanks. So tell us a little bit about your story.
So I came to America in 1992 from Pakistan. We lived in New York. We moved to Connecticut when I was going to second grade. And we are fortunate enough to move to a middle-class area with a good school system when I was in fourth grade. And that's basically where I had majority of my education. And unfortunately, when I was a freshman in high school, which was ninth grade, second day of high school was when 9/11 happened, and it really affected me personally because originally I wasn't born with the name Rehan. I had to get it changed because my name was Usama, and that, as you guys know, was name of one of the terrorists. So I had a very challenging experience, but I learned through that experience that a lot of my teachers had my back, a lot of my friends had my back, and my family had my back, and it really did help shape the individual I am today.
That must have been a difficult time after 9/11. So tell us, when you said it, you had difficulties, I mean, what were some of the things that, you know, some of your classmates or others said to you?
Again, these people were in the minority. There weren't too many individuals, but just one thing that will always stay with me is when they called me a terrorist. It just, when you're at that age, you would never expect someone to call you something like that. I think it really can affect a young individual, and it did. I'm not ashamed to say that. Originally, at first, I was very quiet about it. I didn't tell too many individuals. I kept the burden on my shoulders because I didn't want to involve my parents because I think they already knew that 9/11 had an impact on me, because I remember the following day, which was a Wednesday, I had called out sick because I really didn't want to go to school. Mm-hmm. And you can tell this is an emotional topic for me. Yeah. But I don't want to say there was any physical alterations, but I was pushed around a couple of times. It was just more verbal.
And now you're an adult many years later, and this still resonates with you. I mean, how did that impact you as you moved on to college and your career?
One thing my mother always says, still to this day, is that I went through such, for me, it was a difficult situation. Now, granted, I know people go through many other difficult situations, even more so than I did. But it really did help teach me that I had a support system with my friends, with my family, and that I should never, you know, feel like I'm alone. And a lot of my friends did not have the same background, were not the same ethnicity, but they had my back. And that's something that resonated with me, and that's what I tell my younger cousins, that you're not in it alone. You don't need to, you know, hold things in. And I think as Quinn was saying it before, I don't want to generalize, but as Asian Americans, we might not reach out to a lot of the programs we have to help individuals regardless of their age. So this is why I wanted to bring this up. Like, if there's any children listening or young individuals listening, that besides family, you do have your friends, you do have your teachers, there are support groups available in your towns and your environment. You just sometimes you might have to look for them.
Well, Rehan, I thank you for your story. I'd ask that, do you mind holding on for a little bit so we can bring on some of our other guests?
Sure.
Quinn, when you heard Rehan's story, you were nodding often. Quinn Truong is a Vietnamese American. Her family came here as refugees, and she grew up in West Hartford. We were talking about the supports that Asian Americans have, and oftentimes it's you rely on your family, and you may not know where to turn. So tell me, for people who are listening, for populations who maybe culturally are told, you know, to keep it in the family, you know, we're here for you, and we don't want to talk about stress and other things that are happening with people outside the family. And what can you tell them?
I would say that, you know, Asian Americans underutilize the mental health system more than any other ethnic or minority group. And that doesn't mean that we don't have any stressors or anxieties or depression or mental health problems or addiction problems. It just means that we are not good at asking for help, and we're not good at sharing what our issues are. And as a professional in the mental health field, I see over and over again how few Asian Americans utilize the services or the help that are out there. So I encourage us as a community to be more outspoken and more verbal about our needs and about what's going on inside, because I think that bottling that up is going to result in crisis later. You know, coming from a family with a lot of trauma, going through a war, my dad went through, you know, 7 years of being in labor camps, essentially. You know, I think what saved him was being able to share those stories in a way that, you know, made him feel affirmed and heard. And it's really important to be able to reach out. But it is difficult, and it is not in our values to share. I think saving face is a big value, right? And so, and then to reaffirm what our speaker, our other guest speaker said, you know, I think there are a lot of great educators in the communities who, you know, were there for me when I was growing up. A lot of my teachers and throughout school, throughout the West Hartford school systems, are still in my life today, and they've supported me through some tough times. So I want to encourage our communities to reach out as much as possible.
And Sunny, I wanted to go to you. Growing up as a Chinese American, do you remember being stereotyped and how you dealt with that in the schools?
I mean, here and there, you know, I got, you know, when I was in elementary school, I got making fun of, you know, because, like I said, I didn't speak any English. I'll come here and say, you know, because obviously Chinese sounds different as English or, you know, Vietnamese, whatever. And they're, you know, kids would just, you know, pick on me. And also because, you know, my eyes are, you know, different, you know, I you know, but I don't know. I just didn't really, you know, pay much attention, kind of, you know. I mean, I get, you know, here and there sometimes, you know, I didn't really pay much attention to those things.
And you have children now, Sunny?
Yes, I do.
So tell me how your experiences growing up and how that influences how you talk to your children, the second generation.
Well, my son's not even 2 yet, so it's hard. But
you have nephew. I think Lydia had told us a story, a producer, about an interaction that your nephew had.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. So I have a nephew that's, you know, I think he's 8 years old, but you know, he was telling me experience that he, you know, have in soccer practice, where, you know, he goes to soccer practice and even like the coaches call him China man, which is like, as a coach, as a someone that you look up to, you shouldn't be calling an individual you know, some, you know, because of their Chinese. So, you know, what, so what, when he does that, when the coach calls you Chinaman, obviously the kids, your teammates, you know, they would think that, oh, it's fine, for, you know, for the coach call him, so I could call him to, and so when my nephew was telling me the story, I was upset because he was kind of like tearing, you know. He's a very like shy, you know, shy kid, but so I, you know, it's just sad to see that while, you know, it's still, I mean, obviously I think racism will always happen, but it's just sad to see where, you know, it's like from a coach, I mean, actually sometimes from a kid to a kid that about the same age, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, it's okay. I mean, I shouldn't say it's okay, but it's just from a adult, it just, you know.
So let me ask you, you confronted that coach, and what was their reaction when you told them that that's not a proper, I know, label term when you're speaking to my nephew?
No, I haven't confronted. I'm in the process, you know, calling him, but I've just been busy at work.
Yeah.
But
no, it's an uncomfortable conversation to have.
Yeah, definitely. It's whenever I talk about race, you know, it's definitely uncomfortable to have, but, you know, you have to speak up, just like, you know, you have, and when you need something, when you want to voice be heard, you definitely have to speak up and let them know.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're focusing on Asian Americans in our communities. I want to take a call from Sarah from Danbury. Sarah, you're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi, yes. I just wanted to share comments regarding growing up in the Philippines, how different it is, the school system there than the school system here. I noticed that it's very loose. I mean, I don't mean to say the culture here is very loose. I mean, I was in total shock. I was in ninth grade, which is part of the middle school at that time in Danbury, and kids have no respect for their teachers, and I noticed that already. We have such a deep, profound respect to our teacher in where I come from, and it's just, they're like up there next to your parents. And you basically, there are second set of parents, you know, if you're not in school. I mean, if you're not home, you know, your teacher is like your next parent, your parents at all. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the reason why I was calling is that there's the teachers are allowed to basically discipline you in school if you're not behaving. So that's the difference I noticed in the schools here.
So you're from Danbury. That's a fairly diverse community.
It is. But not at the time that I came here. That was in the early 80s when I came here. At that time, there's only like a handful of Asian Americans in Danbury school system. So there were a lot of Vietnamese, and we're all kind of sort of congregated together at the lunchroom. But as far as socializing with other Americans, we hardly did that. We were kind of in our own little world. I think that's the reason of why we're so quiet and model students, is because we were afraid of making fun of.
Mm-hmm. And so you came to America in the 80s. Do you have a family now? Do you have kids in the school system?
Yes. Well, we did. I had family here when we came here, so we had a lot of support system as far as getting around, getting us to the doctors, you know, dealing with how to deal with the other Americans, because I have a lot of cousins who are half Americans and half Asian. So, you know, they were able to give me support as well.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for your call. I wanted to go back to Rehan from Middletown. Are you still with us, Rehan?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
I wanted to ask you, as a Pakistani-American, you had mentioned growing up in a town in Connecticut, mm-hmm. a lot of your support were Caucasian students, and
correct.
They were your close friends. And so
correct.
When you moved on to college, did you find that when you met other South Asians that that you felt connected to them? Did they become a natural support, or did you just feel very American at that point in time?
So my freshman year, I tried at UConn. I tried to
joined the specific Asian communities they had there, the Indian and Pakistani communities. And in my experience, it didn't go as well as others because there was a disconnect. One thing I will always remember was they called me whitewashed whitewashed because that's how I talked. My mannerisms reflected the area I came from. And to them, it meant that I wasn't as Pakistani or Indian as them. And it's very interesting because, you know, one thing you learn as you're growing up, just because you're from Texas or Connecticut doesn't mean, if you speak differently, it doesn't mean you're not Texan. And it doesn't mean you're not Connecticut. It caught me off guard when they had said that. And another thing I'll always remember is I still hung out with my close friends that also went to school with me, and they would call them in our language, or they would call them like white or whitewash. So it kind of did offend me, and it kind of made me do a 180, and I just basically decided to choose my friends more based on their personalities and not because of their backgrounds. Now, again, not everyone has these types of
experiences.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, but this was my experience.
Well, Rehan, I want to thank you for calling and telling us your story. I really appreciate it. And before we take a break, I want to go to a caller from Orange, Connecticut. Sylvester, you're on Where We Live.
Oh, good morning, Lucy. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to say congratulations that this is a great program as an Asian American
in
Connecticut. I've always been wondering if anybody would ever get to the Asian American community. I just wanted to say again, thank you for having the program, the topic in your program on this subject. But I wanted to just make a comment about being an Asian American parent in Connecticut. I'm 60 years old this year, but I have a 6-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. And my wife is from Ansonia. She's Italian, Irish, of Italian Irish background. But at home, I do speak, although I was born in Minnesota, I grew up in the Philippines. And I learned 3 of the dialects over there. And as my children are growing up, I am actually speaking to them in one of those 3, one dialect I feel most comfortable with. And then, of course, I'm also trying to get my children to learn Spanish as well as hopefully Chinese and Arabic. But in Connecticut, I've found since the children were coming along that it's very difficult to get Connecticut engaged in languages. And that's all I really wanted to throw out there.
That's really interesting. And good luck raising those young ones. I hear you there.
Thank you very much. And great program.
Thank you very much, Sylvester. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're focusing on Asian Americans this hour. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to hear from Jeff Yang, featured contributor for CNN Opinion. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Asian American population in Connecticut has grown by 65% from 2000 to 2010, and federal data shows that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders make up one of the fastest growing racial groups in the country. In studio with me are 2 Connecticut residents who are Asian Americans, Sunny Chen and Quinn Truong. And joining us now by phone is Jeff Yang, featured contributor for CNN Opinion. He's also the author of several books, including I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action, and Eastern Standard Time, a guide to Asian influence in American culture from Astro Boy to Zen Buddhism. Jeff, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you, Lucy.
So I understand that your son, Hudson, is the star of the hit ABC television series Fresh Off the Boat. For those of us who are unfamiliar with the show, what's it about?
It's about a family that moves from an inner city urban enclave that's very diverse, a Chinatown area, to a white suburban neighborhood down in Orlando, Florida, and has to deal with the feelings of dislocation and isolation that, you know, being a fish out of water really brings to you as an immigrant in America.
So let's listen to an excerpt from the show. This is an interaction between the parents. Father Luis Huang is played by Randall Park, and the mother, Jessica Huang, played by Constance Wu.
Great news! I joined the country club. We're all members.
No, we're not doing that anymore. Cancel the membership.
What?
We need to reconnect with our culture, not surround ourselves with white people doing white things.
You know what's a white thing? Hanging up a Buddha picture. Jessica, you got me all excited about the country club, and now I want to do it.
Our parents made sure we knew where we came from. We need to do the same thing for the boys.
So interesting hearing about some of the conflicts as first-generation families navigate living in the U.S. Tell me a little bit about your background, Jeff.
Well, I was born in the United States. In fact, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, one of the most diverse places in one of the most diverse cities in America. But I grew up still primarily surrounded by people who didn't share my background, you know, who weren't Taiwanese American, who didn't bring, you know, leftovers from dinner for lunch the next day and have people kind of say, hey, you know, what is that stuff you're eating? So I definitely felt a lot of empathy, a lot of first-person nostalgia in a lot of ways, watching Fresh Off the Boat at the things that my son, who plays the sort of lead kid, the lens through which all this action is taking place, goes through as a child himself. And the show's set in the 1990s, so it's very much of a period and one that I recognize personally.
So there's been a lot of TV shows recently with characters and narratives that highlight the day-to-day lives of Asian Americans. So Fresh Off the Boat, I'm thinking about The Mindy Project starring Mindy Kaling and Master of None starring Aziz Ansari. So why do you think that more and more of these shows pop up, and why is there such a difference when we look at Hollywood?
So I think that something really interesting is happening right now with television in particular. There's a lot of TV. People talk about peak TV, more good quality, interesting stuff to watch than eyeballs to really watch it. And part of this is because TV itself is changing. You have so many more places to watch TV. You've got streaming. You've got cable. You've got network, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're seeing, I think, is that because there are so many more platforms, people are experimenting more to try to grab eyeballs that historically haven't actually been focused on. And Asian Americans, I think, are you know, maybe one of the best examples of that. It's been 20-some years before since the last show we saw that had an Asian American family at its core, All American Girl, which was back in 1996, 1997. So that's one reason. The other reason is simply put, television is a place where you could call it almost like a trailing indicator of what America's mores and social values and cultural acceptance looks like. When something appears on TV, it means that, you know, maybe the rest of the world is kind of ready to talk about it and see it and invite it into their living rooms. So, you know, we finally reached a place where I think Asian Americans in particular have, you know, grown in size and stature and profile that America and the television industry is really ready to say, hey, we can't ignore this group quite so much anymore. And that's why they took this a little bit of a flyer, perhaps, on putting Fresh Off the Boat out there. It was a success. And as we all know, in Hollywood, when success happens, people follow.
I don't know if you heard the last segment. We had a caller who is Pakistani-American, and growing up, you know, he would meet other Pakistanis who would kind of accuse him of being whitewashed. And I thought about that hashtag campaign going on right now in social media. Tell us about the whitewashing campaign of Hollywood.
Yeah. So one of the weird things is that even though television has changed in this fashion, movies really haven't. I mean, we've gotten to a point now where Asian Americans are puzzled by the fact that we can't even get Asian actors to play Asian roles. That when there are stories that clearly have Asian protagonists in mind in their original source matter, you know, Hollywood and specifically the motion picture studios still aren't convinced that an Asian performer, an Asian actor, has the talent, the stature, the credit, the box office appeal to cast in that role. So they rewrite the role for a non-Asian, or they simply cast a non-Asian in the role, pretending we won't notice that, you know, Scarlett Johansson is not, in fact, Japanese, stuff like that. So on Twitter, which has kind of become the, you know, the megaphone of Asian America, there have been people using this hashtag, whitewashed out, to talk about the fact that roles that arguably could be star-making roles for Asians are being recast as non-Asian with the ironic excuse that there are no Asian stars.
We have two Asian Americans in studio with me, Sunny Chen, who's Chinese American, also Quinn Truong, who is Vietnamese American. Growing up, did you wish that you saw more faces like yourselves on television?
Oh, definitely. I looked for people who looked slightly Asian or had slightly Asian-sounding names, and I think when Lucy Liu came out, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. I want to be her when I grow up. But I think it's hard to be Asian American growing up in a predominantly Caucasian community and feeling like you're pretty or you look like everybody else or that you're going to be measured in the same way. And so it's definitely affirming to see Asian Americans in popular media, although that wasn't the case very much.
I know, Sunny, you're busy working and operating a restaurant much of the week, so you probably don't have a lot of time to watch television. But do you see the subtle differences from the time when you were growing up and now, or are you seeing more Asian Americans in these roles?
I mean, I see a lot of, Jackie Chan movie and, a lot of not just Asian people likes Jackie Chan, like, feel like, other race, they love the karate movie. So, yeah.
Yeah, who doesn't love Jackie Chan? but I want to go back to you, Jeff Yang. We've just got a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you just personally, your son's role on Fresh Off the Boat. How has that influenced or changed the conversations that you're having in your family about race, about stereotyping that goes on in pop culture?
You know, I think the most interesting thing about it, other than the fact that when you have a kid who is thrust from anonymity to, being the star of a TV show, a lot of dynamics just change in general. I mean, he walks out in public and you have people, not just other Asian Americans, not even just kids, but people of all ages, backgrounds, races, ethnicities, who are coming up to him and saying, oh man, Eddie Huang, let me get a selfie with you. But the topics that are being talked about in Fresh Off the Boat are issues that, as a 12-year-old, in a lot of ways, he's been lucky enough not to have to face. You know, I grew up in a time, and I think your other guests grew up in a time when it was pretty consistent that at school, in the playground, we'd get called out. We'd be the only one, out there and a lightning rod for some of the sort of naive abuse that occurs at that age range. And Hudson, I think, and my other son, Skylar, have both grown up in worlds and backgrounds where they've been surrounded by diversity and they've been surrounded by people for whom the food they bring to lunch is actually really cool. And that attitude towards difference, being different today, people find it interesting, appealing, something that they want to experience as opposed to something that they fear and reject. At that age range, that's something that really gives me hope. So when I talk about these things with Hudson, it's just refreshing and life-affirming to hear him say, that's something that I haven't actually seen. And when I do see it, I have friends who back me up, as opposed to the circumstances I faced when I was growing up at his age.
You just triggered a memory I had growing up in Western Pennsylvania, one of the very few Indian Americans in my school. And one day I brought some curry in, and I remember the kids at the table going, "What is that?"
The lunchbox moment.
And yeah. I thought I had blocked that out, but you just brought it back for me, Jeff Yang. But I want to thank you so much for your contributions. Jeff Yang, thank you so much for joining Where We Live. You're the featured contributor for CNN Opinion. He's also the author of several books, including I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action, Eastern Standard Time, A Guide to Asian Influence in American Culture, From Astro Boy to Zen Buddhism. Thank you so much, Jeff, for your time.
Thank you.
Also in studio, Sunny Chen, Chinese American and West Hartford resident, owner of Black Bamboo. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy.
And Quinn Truong, Vietnamese American and Hartford resident. Thank you, Quinn.
Thanks, Lucy.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. You can continue the conversation on our website, WMPR.org/where we live. Tweet us at Where We Live or at Facebook. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Executive producer is Katie Tolarski. And I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This is Where We Live.